Joining us now, we have Michael Trembath from Trembath & Taylor. Good morning, Trembles.
Hey, Phil. How are you going?
Yeah, I'm really well, thanks. Good. Hey, back when I was starting out in the wine industry, I used to come along to your trade days to taste Italian wine because I wanted to learn about Italian wine, and always an amazing spread. And one day you said, hey, how about we turn some of this into business? To which I said, do you mean you want me to stop mooching free wine from you? And you're like, yeah, well, yes. And it kind of worked though. We've done some amazing events together and I've sold some of your amazing wines. A complete vanity project was we did the whites of Northeast Italy at Grossi Florentino upstairs there.
That was good fun.
That was one of my favorite events I've ever done. And just sort of sitting there and it was amazing. But how did you end up selling Italian wine?
Well, that's a pretty easy question. I went to Rosworthy Agricultural College and graduated in 1980. So I did wine marketing. And when I graduated, I took a job with the wholesalers at the time, W.J. Seabrook and Son. And basically, I got put in charge of the Italian portfolio because nobody else wanted to do it, really. That simple. But I'd only been there a little while, and they said, look, there's a conference in Florence and somebody's got to go, so do you want to go? So, and we were the Antonori agents at the time. So I got put up in Florence by the Antonori family, basically came back, we expanded the Italian portfolio, and we've eventually turned it into a full-time job at Trembath & Taylor.
And you only sell Italian wine now, right?
Only sell Italian wine. So in the early days, we had to sell, we sold Australian wine, French wine, Spanish wine, because the market wasn't there. It wasn't big enough for just Italian wine. But we've been exclusively Italian wine now for just on 20 years.
Isn't that funny to think that there was a point in history where the market wasn't big enough for only Italian wine, and now it's everywhere. It's a staple of Australian drinking culture.
Well, you know, it was funny, but, you know, we had a lot of Italian people moving here and they tended not to drink Italian wine. You know, they made their own or they were discovering, you know, different things made in Australia. And it took some time for Italian wine to really catch on. But when you think about it, they make 20% of the world's wine. So it does sort of stand to reason that sooner or later it had to catch on.
Well, and now, you know, people are drinking Georgian wine and Croatian wine, and it's the same thing. People are like, oh, do they make good wine there? And you're like, well, not all of them, but yeah, you know, there's enough of them that there is good wine there.
Well, there's a big world of wine out there, Phil.
Yeah, and that's great. It's hard to get bored drinking wine, I find. But one of the reasons we had you on is Barolo 2016. There's been a lot of people talking up Barolo 2016. Is it that great?
Short answer, yes.
Yep.
So what the 16s have that I think, Barolo's had a number of pretty handy vintages of recent years. You know, maybe you might look at something like the 2012s and you could accuse them of being a little too sturdy. But 13s were quite nice. 14s maybe a little light, just the way the vintage went. 15, I had a 15 last night, and I think for medium-term drinking, they're fantastic. But what 16 has is topicity, so great, great flavours, you know, the licorice and menthol and, you know, they're very, very correct Nebbiolo flavours. And, of course, the thing with Nebbiolo is it's an acidic and tannic grape variety, but the 16s have a real plushness to them. So not soft, but plush. You know, they're really sweetly fruited at the core, and they have a real sort of plushness to the feel of them, and they're just absolutely delicious. And I think what's going to happen with them is they're going to probably stay together for a long time. And when I say a long time, they could be 20-year cellaring prospects.
And what made 2016 so good?
It was just one of those coming together of the climate. You know, we've had up and down global warming, whatever you want to call it. You know, we've had a cut and thrust of seasons, but 16 was perfect. There was enough rain early in the season for good water retention through a very long and even ripening period. Now, we're talking Barolo specifically here.
Yeah.
And Nebbiolo, which you may or may not know, but Nebbiolo has the longest hang time on the vine to ripen of any red grape variety.
I knew so it was long. I didn't know it was the longest. Yeah.
No, well, it's 100 days from flowering to ripening. So that's fraught with danger if you think about it. It's 3.5 months. So it needs a really great season to turn out classic wines. And 16 was just like that. It was this beautiful, even season the whole way.
That's amazing. And so you mentioned we're talking Barolo specifically. Barbaresco, the kind of the pair, they're not that far away from each other geographically, but they're often quite different. How did Barbaresco fare in 2016?
The Barbaresco 16s are great too, but I take your point, and that is that they're not always super good in the same years.
Yeah.
But of course, when you say they're not far away, and what is it, 20 minutes by car, don't forget the altitude is significantly different. It's 200 metres difference in altitude. So they do have substantially different climatic effect. And in fact, Barbaresco would normally start harvesting 3 weeks before Barolo. So there's a big difference.
That's it's amazing, isn't it? And just to think that they basically only grow Nebbiolo. Is Nebbiolo clones as big a thing as it is, say, with Pinot?
Absolutely. And in fact, we started here with, in Australia, when we started with Nebbiolo, we had only 4 clones.
Yeah.
And one of them was the Rosé clone, which is not really ideal for making statuesque long-term cellaring red. And the other thing was the 4 clones that we started with in Australia all came through the University of California at Davis.
Yeah.
So there were issues with the clones, as in they may not have been as faithful to the actual clone itself as we would have liked. Clonal selection and variation in Nebbiolo is a very important thing. And it is a bit like Pinot, but basically, you know, you get those, the Pinot that can be so sort of fruity and simple.
Yeah.
You have the same thing with certain Nebbiolo clones. So you need to have a mix where you've got some structural elements and whatever. It's the same.
Why do people talk about Pinot clones and never any other clones? You know, I've never really understood that, why Pinot clones are so emphasised where other grapes aren't.
Yeah, well, that's a funny question because I don't really know. I mean, if you think about, I mean, I have more to do with clonal work with Sangiovese than I do with Nebbiolo. And there's currently, you know, like 80 different clones of Sangiovese planted out around Tuscany in volume.
Yeah.
Nebbiolo would be, you know, probably in the 20s or 30s, I would think, maybe even 40. And people don't talk about it that much, but maybe that's because when we started, I think some of the history might be with Australian Pinot. When it started off, there was a lot of interest. And then, you know, it had this sort of period where the interest waned because people were finding that the wine was a little lackluster, perhaps, or a little simple, and it was expensive. Then it sort of came back, and I think that comeback might have been because people were working out what to do with the various clones and how to make them.
Yep. That would make absolute sense. And just a slightly off the topic question, but in Australia, you talked about the clones that we have for Nebbiolo. Is there anyone that you think is making a particularly good show of Nebbiolo in Australia at the moment?
Yeah, well, that's a great question as well. Now, of recent times, Matt, my business partner, and I have done some tastings for a number of the winemaking groups. So the Heathcote winemakers. Funnily enough, we did one for the Rutherglen winemakers, Beechworth winemakers.
Yep.
And from what I can see, looks to me like Beechworth might be providing the best material for Nebbiolo. Certainly the Gioconda wine is very good. I like one from a winery called Trabbiati.
I like the Trabbiati too. Yeah, we've had Simon the Trabbiati.
Yeah, that's very good. So, you know, and they're getting a large degree of varietal impact into the wine. And I think that something else here, Phil, and while we're off sort of that track, is one of the wines or a set of the wines we've been showing the winemakers are not Barolo, not Barbaresco, but other Nebbiolo made in Piedmont. So Alto Piemonte. So Nebbiolo wines that are what I would call medium-bodied, beautifully aromatic, And I think that Australia could make a very good fist of that style of wine, as opposed to trying to go out and make Barolo every time you touch the Nebbiolo grape.
Yeah.
And I think you'll find that the consumer, I mean, we're having quite a lot of success with that style of wine. And I think the Australian consumer will eventually latch on to that style of wine, assuming we're successful at making it. And the Traviati is probably a good example.
Yep. Yeah. I tend to agree, and I put his wine on at an event, Piedmont versus Australia. They really wanted to compare Nebbiolo from Australia and Piedmont, and I did kind of say to them, it's a bit of a hard ask. The Australian wines aren't quite at Barolo standards yet. Like, we can do the, you know, the Lange style and some of those lighter ones, but when we get into Barolo, there's nothing in Australia that really compares, and, you know, eventually they probably will, but It was a bit of a tough ask in the end, because we drank some amazing Barolo.
Well, yeah, that's a really tough comparative exercise, that one, I agree.
And if you were to plant a Nebbiolo vineyard in Australia, where would you plant it?
Well, I mean, as I said just before, Beechworth seems to be delivering up some goods. I mean, back to the actual grape, if it's going to hang on the vine for 3.5 months, it's going to need to be not somewhere too warm. It's got to be somewhere, though, that can be temperate enough to affect ripeness. In that regard, maybe Beechworth, because of the elevation, it's maybe Beechworth does actually fit the bill. But who knows? I mean, I haven't seen a lot of stuff out of the West, but there could be quite a number of areas, Phil. I mean, it's not, from what I see, the soil doesn't have that much to do with it. It's more about the climate and perhaps the exposure.
All right, so that's what we're looking for. I just I like you am not sure that we found the best sites for Nebbiolo in Australia, but hopefully people keep planting it and we'll see, because it's, I mean, Nebbiolo is an amazing grape. Hey, can we just take a quick break? We'll listen to a couple of messages and we'll come back and keep chatting about Nebbiolo.
Yep, sure.
You are back live on The Wine Show, 96.5 Inner FM. My guest is Michael Trembarth from Trembarth & Taylor, and we are talking about Barolo and Nebbiolo and all those lovely things. Michael, one of the reasons I asked you to come on was because I tried one of your 2016 Barolo that's in the country. It's Brico Guibellini, and excuse my pronunciation. And so I bought some for a customer who was after some of the 2016 Barolos, and there's not many in the country yet. And I tasted it and went, wow, this is pretty special. And I called you and said, hey, it's good wine. You're like, you know, it's a special wine, right? And what, it's an amazing story behind it, and it's a relatively young estate. Can you tell us how it all came about?
Yeah, well, Brico Guibellini, it's a real labor of love as far as we're concerned. It's something, I mean, we really do love this this wine. Now, it's a very small vineyard in Monforte, so in the heartland area of Barolo. It's actually the highest vineyard in Barolo as well. And when I say very small, it's about a third of a hectare, and it's a husband and wife operation who basically met and married quite late in life, and they're doing this project around the house where they live as, I think, basically a retirement project. The wine is made at Contorno Fantino, which is an adjacent winery, so literally just down the hill. And we buy it all at Trembarth & Taylor. So, but when I say we buy it all, they might make 2 barrels one year, they might make 4 barrels the other. So there's not a lot of wine.
No.
But you've seen the wine. The wine's fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a beautiful wine. And There's only two that I've had to date, because as I said, there's not many in the country, but that is just the sort of silkiness and the sort of succulent palate, which is something you touched on 2016 kind of has, was a real standout.
I think the thing about the Brico Guibellini wine that I really love is the aromaticity of it.
Yeah.
So that site and the height. So it's interesting, this, Phil, because, you know, Nebbiolo, the sites are generally the highest. So the three grape varieties, Dolcetto, Barbera, and Nebbiolo, are sorted in terms of the exposure. So Dolcetto goes in on the lower slopes, then Barbera on the mid slopes, and the upper slopes, southerly exposed, are reserved for Nebbiolo. But the appellation actually calls for a maximum height level, which is 535 metres above sea level. And the Brico Giubilini vineyard is at 530. So it only just scrapes in. So if they made the wine on the roof, they'd be in trouble.
And
but that altitude gives the wine a fantastic aroma, and that's typical year in, year out. But with 16, you really see it in, you know, in a total fullness. It's magnificent.
And the altitude means they're picking later again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So at Brico Giubilini, if you were sitting in their dining room, which doubles as the tasting room, as I say, it's a very small operation. They've got what's essentially a picture window that looks out onto the Alps. And, you know, it's an amazing view as well. And, I mean, sometimes you're there, the fire's going, you're drinking Barolo and looking at the snow-capped Alps. It's just another world.
That sounds absolutely perfect. Now, help me out. Brico means sort of top of the hill or near the top of the hill?
Well, Brico is a hill.
A hill?
Yeah, the top of the hill.
Yeah. And does Giubilini have a meaning? Is that?
Well, Giubilini's a bit of a playoff on that zone's been called that for a long time, but it's a bit of a playoff on jubilant or joyous, that type of thing.
Yeah.
So jubilant would be jubilo, I think, in Italian, something along those lines.
So the scene you described, fire going, drinking Barolo, the top of the hill, looking at the Alps, kind of describes it perfectly.
Yeah, kind of describes it pretty well, doesn't it?
And you said that the wine's made by Contino Fantino, which is a winery I've loved probably for as long as I've been going to your trade days. What is it about their style that makes them so special?
Well, the Contino Fantino wines for many years were made by Guido Fantino. And the Contino is Claudio Contino, the viticulturist. So they were a fantastic coming together of people that knew a great viticulturist and a great winemaker. These days, the wine's made by Fabio Fantino, so Guido's son. But he continues on in the style. And the style has always been very, I call it high-toned, but I don't know if people really understand what that means. But they have a lot of aromatics. They border on a lot of volatiles. Not volatiles. They're not volatile, but they're very lifted aromatically, and so that it really didn't surprise me, I guess, that Maria and Gigi from Brico Giubilini took to Fabio to make their wine. And back to what you said earlier, it's only a youngish operation. The first vintage was 2008.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And how hard is it to buy like a third of a hectare in Barolo?
Land in Barolo is quite expensive. I mean, it's pushing up towards Burgundian prices. So depending where you're trying to buy and what you're trying to do, if you're looking for absolute prime Nebbiolo vineyard area, it could be $1 million Australian a hectare.
Yeah.
So I guess it is hard to buy because you need $1 million Australian a hectare.
And is it for sale? Like, are people selling vineyards or is it pretty closely kept?
Look, I think it's not sort of like going around and seeing real estate signs up in the vineyard left, right and centre.
Yeah.
But there's always some commercial activity in terms of selling and people retiring or, you know, families busting up or whatever, you know. So there is a bit of that goes on.
I have no plans on doing it myself, but it's interesting when you hear people, they buy a small patch in, you know, like a high quality region and you think, you know, how easy is it to do? Or is it like, you know, could you just walk up to people and say, hey, you know, it's a nice plot of land. If I give you enough money, would you sell it? Is it that kind of thing? Or do people, like, hold on to it, you know, family history and that kind of thing?
Well, there's a long family history with a lot of the wineries, so they tend to hang on to it.
Yeah. Very good. Michael, I have a million more questions, but we need to keep rolling with the show. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And you've got more Barolo coming on the line, don't you? You've got more on the water?
Yep, we have. So in 16 Barolo, in fact, we just tried the new Marcarini wines last Thursday at the office, so they're on the way later in the year. The next to arrive is from Chiara Boscas.
Yeah.
So they're here in about 6 weeks' time.
Yeah.
So there's been a bit of a delay, and a bit of, some of this stuff is coming in late because of the COVID situation, but they'll all come through in due course.
And people just can keep watching the offers from around Australia and jump on the very best of them, which sounds like they're all pretty, it's a pretty good year to invest if you're going to buy, especially wines to keep.
Absolutely.
Excellent. Thanks, Trembles. I've enjoyed our chat, always. And yeah, we'll catch up soon, hopefully, once it's all safe and sensible.
Good to talk to you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So here's Michael Trembath from Trembath and Taylor, selling some amazing Italian wine from all sorts, not just expensive Barolo, but also some really lovely entry-level Italian stuff.